I like this. We just launched straight into this.
I left both of you groups at more or less the same point, which is kind of handy with a brief outline of the harvest model. And so we're going to pick it up from there. And is John in the room?
Yes.
Good.
Next slide.
Next slide, please. Okay. The second group got this slide, but not the first, although the second group did not actually get this slide. But this is the fundamental problem of federated search, is that in a federated search, you only have one voice describing the metadata, because the metadata that you retrieve is coming in real time directly and only from the producer of that resource. So, for example, if Disney has a repository of learning resources, they have a federated search, the information is coming straight from Disney. Which means that metadata on the federated search model basically is nothing more than advertising. And there's no opportunity in your search results to have anything like other voices, evaluation, criticism. Disney's not going to put the criticisms in its metadata, right? So federated search is, in my mind, about control. It's about control of the message. Control of the access and control of the message. And that's what makes it fundamentally wrong.
Next slide, please.
So, this is right now. We need to pretend those little stutters didn't exist. David Hume once wrote a book called The Treatise of Human Nature. And a very important, fundamental book that changed how people think about knowledge and about learning. And the book, as he described it, fell stillborn from the press. Completely ignored. Much the same has happened to a paper that I wrote called Resource Profiles. But I think that we need to revive this sort of concept. The picture of metadata that we have now is the picture like the label on a can of soup, right? Where, and if you haven't seen that metaphor, dozens and dozens of places, where there's one location for this metadata, there's one voice describing the contents of the soup, and that's it, you're done with it. Oh, am I missing a letter there? Oh, well. And the language on that Campbell's soup can, you have Campbell's soup here, yeah. Is specifically for soup, right? It's soup metadata. Soup metadata exists apart from sausage metadata, apart from apple juice metadata, apart from Ford Taurus metadata. Now, we need to rethink this. We have the idea right now that there should be metadata specifically for learning. There should be an F in there. And in a sense, yes, but in a much more important sense, no. If you look at learning object metadata, learning object metadata contains a few tags that discuss technical format, right? Well, there are many other metadata formats or metadata vocabularies that are much better at describing technical format, because depending on the nature of the resource, you need to describe it in different ways. The technical format for a video is very different from the technical format for a PDF file, is very different from the technical format for an image. Appropriate metadata should be used for each of these separate formats. But these are not all going to be defined by educational institutions. These are going to be defined by the people who work in video, by the people who work in images, by the people who work in PDF files. Learning object metadata presupposes that there is going to be one metadata standard, the 87 fields, that's used by everyone. This is very unlikely to be the case in the long term. And the experience with RSS is a very good example of that. RSS satisfies nobody, which is, again, kind of ironic, seeing as it's so widely adopted. But one of the things that makes RSS work is people can add to RSS as they want. RSAN, RSS, and people add Dublin Core information to it. People add syndication information into it. People add Creative Commons information into it. And it doesn't break the standard. And when people harvest RSS, they don't read everything, they just read what they want. And if they don't want some of the information that's there, they just ignore it. If some of the information that they want isn't there, then they either say, well, then I'm not going to harvest this resource, or they make it up. You might not believe it, but you really do. I have lots of stuff on my site. The title is called Untitled. They didn't give me a title in the RSS. Well, that's fine. I'll just make one up and I'll put it in there. Metadata can be, should be, mix and match, right? You use the metadata tags appropriate for whatever it is that you're doing at the time. And metadata needs to be authored by multiple people. Take, for example, the description of a book, right? You have certain information like the publisher, the author, the number of pages, so on and so forth, the title. But then you have the reviewer's comments, the reader's comments. Then you have the pricing information, which changes from place to place. Then you have the cataloging of the book, put it in fiction, put it in drama, put it in world history. All of this information about a book is written by many different people. And of course, it would have to be that way. And so also must learning object metadata. Slide, please. In my paper, Resource Profiles, I identified three major types of metadata. First-party metadata, second-party metadata, third-party metadata. First-party metadata is what we may call bibliographic metadata. This is information about the resource produced by the creator of the resource. It's relatively non-controversial. It's the title of the resource. Somebody gives you a title of a resource, they're probably right. The author of a resource. The publisher, stuff like that. Also, first-party resource would typically also include rights information. Who owns the copyright to it? If it's for sale, how much does it cost? Stuff like that. That's first-party. That's the people who created it. Second-party is a new category. Probably haven't seen this before. This is metadata created by the people who use the resource. For example, suppose I'm a student and I use a certain piece of content while I'm creating a project on Roman history. And suppose it's a picture of a chariot, right? So I say, I do my search, I find my chariot, I drag and drop it into my project. That should produce some metadata. And the metadata here is the context of use. We now know, because I've used it in this way, that this picture can be used in the context of talking about the Roman Empire. It's use-generated metadata. Most educational metadata falls into this category. We talk about typical age range is part of learning object metadata. How do we know that a resource is appropriate for a typical age range? Well, because teachers selected it and used it for that age. How do we know a resource is appropriate for a certain class? Because teachers used it in that class, or the students themselves chose it and used it in that class. Semantic density, same sort of thing. This is particularly the case if we have, and this model suggests that we do, if we have demographic information about the user of the resource and the context of use and the time of use. It's a three-part thing, right? The resource, the context of use, the class, the age range, the date, the country, the language, and then the user. Right? The user's educational attainment, the time that the user used the resource, things like that. These three things produce second-party metadata. Enormously powerful, enormously descriptive. It would make no sense to have the author of a learning object try to guess, because that's all they're guessing, right? Look at the context of use. Third-party metadata is metadata produced by somebody who is not the author and who is not the consumer. They're a third party. They're sort of standing there and they're looking at this thing. And typical things that third parties do is they classify. That's what librarians do. That's why we use librarians to classify learning resources, because librarians know the system of classification and can be relied on to classify correctly and consistently. Evaluations of learning resources. People are talking about quality. And one picture of quality, right, is you lock the door and you put big Bruce at the door and you make sure only the approved people get in. And the result of that is you get a big lineup. And Merlot uses that approach, right? It's peer reviewed. And Merlot's been in operation 5 years, something like that. They're still trying to get, you know, 1,000 or whatever learning objects peer reviewed because it's a bottleneck. But if you let just anybody evaluate, people evaluate what they want, users sometimes evaluate, observers evaluate, and you capture that information, now your evaluations are distributed and made available as metadata. So we don't need to depend on Merlot's special system to evaluate. Anybody can evaluate. People can become the Siskel and Ebert of learning objects if they want. And they can use a very simple classification system. Two thumbs up, two thumbs down. Or they can use a very complex classification system, depending on what they do. And the grounds on which the evaluation takes place can and should be varied. For certain communities, the content will be very important. For example, the Mormons, the Church of Latter-day Saints, may want to evaluate learning objects. They'll have, you know, a two-value system, right? You know, Mormon approved, Mormon not approved. It's kind of like the Education AU filters. But they can and should have the right and the ability to do that. I shouldn't make fun of Mormons because it's very serious, the classifications that they undertake. They need to be able to have that say. When I worked in Manitoba creating learning resources for rural high schools, one of the rural high schools that we served was in a Hutterite community. And you'll have to look up Hutterite, I can't explain it. And the Hutterite community, again, they generally avoid technology, they generally avoid urban, just the whole urban phenomena. I mean, our class was in, world politics. And so we needed to be careful about the resources that were going to this community. And the question was, well, how do we approach this? Do we make, everything Hutterite appropriate? Well, that wouldn't make sense. But what we needed and what we didn't have was a way for the Hutterites to be able to label the content as approved by the elders of their community. So on and so forth. Now that you see the concept, the examples multiply, don't they? Communist-approved resources, right? This resource is worker-friendly. So on and so forth. We should have multiple evaluations. Next slide, please. So, what we get is the concept, the idea of the resource profile. It's similar to the idea of a personal profile. If you think about it, when a baby is born in the world, a baby doesn't come with a whole lot of metadata. Right? Have a birth date. Kind of comes with the territory. Has a place of birth. May or may not have a name. We usually have a partial name, but not always a full name. It took like a full week before I got a full name. They went with the German theme. I still don't know why. But I like it. And the other metadata, have a birth weight. Of course, now weight is a metadata. It's very dynamic metadata. It tends to grow. Sometimes some of us never stops growing. So on and so forth. Right? And as the child progresses through life, the child acquires a profile, an educational profile, grades, courses completed, so on, a sports profile. I once scored 40 goals in intramural hockey. Not very useful metadata, but it's part of my profile. Inoculations, medical records, so on and so forth. And as the child grows older, even more data becomes available. They may get a driver's license. They get a social insurance number. I assume you have something similar here. They may get a criminal record. That's metadata, isn't it? Now, and if you think about it, this sort of stuff has to be distributed, right? Because you don't want the child, the person themselves, responsible for their own criminal record. Right? You need a third party to be handling that, because otherwise you can, you know what resumes are like, people lie. And that's the life cycle of a learning object, a learning resource, any resource. And the resource comes into the world, it doesn't have many properties because it hasn't done very much, hasn't been used. But as it gets used, as it circulates, then it acquires the properties that it has. And as these things happen, that's when the metadata gets created. And the metadata gets created automatically, en passant, as they say, in the progress, in the process of being used. So 87 fields, nobody would fill out 87 fields, especially when about 80 of those fields are pure guesswork. So, look at the picture. We have multiple authors of metadata. We have multiple types of metadata. I mean, these types are mixed and matched. If I'm viewing the profile of an object, honestly, I respect their community, but I don't care how the Mormons evaluated it. I do care how the communists evaluated it. That's just a joke. But not that much. But you know what I mean, right? So, there is no such thing as the learning object metadata. Each assemblage of learning object metadata is a view on the object. But of course, how else could you have personalized information retrieval and delivery except through multiple views on the metadata? Next slide. There's no single source, no single location. This metadata is held in different places. The Mormon metadata is in Utah. The Library of Congress metadata is in Washington. The Stevens thumbs up, thumbs down, and yeah, there will be one, is in Moncton. Actually, it's mainly thumbs down. So on and so forth. Wright's metadata, I won't go into it in detail here. The model that's mostly thought of for digital rights expression, the rights associated with an object travel with the object. That makes no sense. Put the rights information somewhere else, so that if the object metadata is out there, you can still change the permissions on it. So if you're trying to sell it, you can change the price. Things like that. Evaluation use reports distributed all over the place. And how does that work? How could you possibly pull that off? You harvest it. Try pulling this off in a federated search system. This model will not work in a federated system. You cannot do it. The only way to make this work is with a harvest system. And in order for a lot of the capacities that we want, we have to make this work. Therefore, we have to use a harvest system. A federated system breaks this model. Next slide, please.
It's almost 1 o'clock, Stephen. So.
Yep. Almost there. Here's the picture. The producers produce metadata. The metadata is syndicated by aggregators. There are numerous aggregators, not just one. The aggregators remix and send it out to the consumers, who, of course, send in the feedback loop. That's the model. Next slide, please. What you just saw, of course, was a network, and specifically a neural network. We know a lot about these networks. We understand these properties. We understand them at the biological level. We understand them at the mathematical level. We know that they are redundant.
That's a good word.
That's a good word. They are robust. They are reliable. They're redundant. You can break a part of it, and unlike Windows, the network won't crash. They are, to use the slogan, small pieces loosely joined. Each unit of the network is very simple. What makes the unit the thing it is the connections that it has with the other units. What makes an aggregator the aggregator it is, are the things that it harvests from and the users that it sends things to. such networks are self-organized. This kind of network will organize itself. It organizes itself because each entity in this network is attending to its own interests, its own task. And the result of this, and we know this is mathematically known, this network will produce organized output. It will, for example, cluster naturally on its own. This is already an observed phenomenon. It will produce reliable search results without even having to search. It has a capacity for growth. It's infinitely scalable. We don't run into bandwidth issues because bandwidth issues are an extension of a network, and each network is small. Each unit is small. Each unit runs on its own limited amount of bandwidth. And this is where all of my, well, not all, but a big part of the whole other stuff you see in my newsletter comes from. For this to work, you have to have something like open access. Because if you cut off all those links, the network won't work. If you restrict the flow from harvest or from source to harvester to consumer, then the network won't work. There has to be autonomy at the unit level. If you try to get every search system the same, you haven't produced the variable capacity that the network needs in order to work. And you need feedback. In the science of neural networks, they call that backpropagation. Backpropagation is what tells the network how to organize itself. There's no such mechanism in federated search. There's no way you can go back and tell a federated search, "Ah, you were wrong." Next, please. I'm partway through demonstrating this. I've built two major systems, EduRSS and DWARN. EduRSS is the more developed of the two. It harvests RSS feeds from blogs, journals, websites, mailing lists related to the field of educational technology. Brings these things together, schmooshes around the metadata a little bit, organizes the output into topics, and then sends 107 topic-specific feeds. If you access EduRSS on learning objects, you will, I guarantee you, and I'll subject this to empirical proof by anyone who cares to do it, have the most authoritative source on learning objects in the world. Guaranteed. Test it. Go look at EduRSS, look at the learning objects feed, compare that with any other source of information available on learning objects. By far and away the most authoritative. How much work does it take me to run EduRSS? Well, I tweak the list of sites that I harvest once every month or so. Otherwise, it's completely automated. It's only a partial demonstration. I have not yet incorporated the feedback. The world has not yet incorporated the third-party metadata, so there's a lack of some of this stuff. But the principle is already proving itself. DLORN, I've done the same thing, except for learning object metadata. I harvest RSS from Edna, Merlot, and so on and so forth. And there's a commercial-grade version of it. Next, and I think last. So the big idea here is, the old picture, e-learning is static, e-learning is course-based, e-learning is institution-based, e-learning is vertical. The new picture, e-learning is dynamic. It's unstructured. It's a stream of learning resources flowing through a self-organizing network with feedback, multiple points of view, dynamic management of information. I think that's the last. So, and I know I'm out of time.
Yes.
So that's the picture that I'm presenting. I know you didn't challenge me this talk. We've got a workshop. I've got a website. Send me your slings and arrows. But this, I'm quite convinced that this is the picture. And if this is the picture, our educational technology community is wrong. And that should give us some pause for thought, right? Thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Stephen. And I know it's around about 5 past 1, so unless I'm